Today is April 4th, 2018, and this is episode number 456 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, and I'm on top of the world looking down on creation, and the only explanation I can find is to get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, to head over to macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at facebook.com/group/context machine.
I had no idea that I was going to have to be a backup singer today.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Well, I accept your apology. Wait, that's the other inappropriate response.
There's so many to choose from. Maybe what we need to do is set up like a little spinner wheel for you. And you just flick the arrow, and where it stops, that's the response.
Yeah, that'll work. See, it's close enough.
You know, we could probably do a whole show where we each have a spinner wheel, mm-hmm. and we just flick the thing and read what it comes up with, and it would probably sound a lot like what we do anyhow.
That's true. By the way, fidget spinners are a bit of a sore spot right now.
Why?
In some quarters. So let's, you know, just be careful.
All right. Are you having fidget spinner issues?
I am not. There are people who are.
All right. Well, I hope it works out so that those people don't have to have fidget spinner issues.
Indeed, right? That would be on top of the world looking.
Yeah. Oh, good times.
Yeah, good times. Good times. All right. Well, today's topics, we have a couple of topics. First of all, we have you know what? Let's get our mea culpas out of the way first.
Okay.
We owe Craig an apology.
Oh, what did you do to Craig?
Well, Craig is the one who gave us a couple of weeks ago. We were going to apologize last week, but then we had Laura Bain on the show.
Right. It was a fun show.
It was a fun show. It was great getting that education perspective direct from the, with all apologies to Laura, from the horse's mouth.
Yeah. Well, apology accepted.
So anyway, we were going to mention this last week and then we forgot, but Craig had emailed us with some complaints about this whole notion about, you know, all these shared cars,
autonomous vehicles, that whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was like, you know, if we need to get out of town fast, you know, we're not going to want to call an Uber. And I said, well, you know, if we have an incoming nuclear attack and there's some sort of mass evacuation, shared cars or whatever, you know, it's none of that's going to even matter. Do you remember this?
I do. You went right to the nuclear option.
I went right to the nuclear option. I totally did. And he wrote in and saying, I must comment on your nuclear attack lead. Not fair. That was your made up scenario, not mine. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Craig was not talking about the nuclear option, and I essentially was being hyperbolic. But I mean, really, I think that any kind of mass evacuation, I think that what studies have found is that evacuations don't work. And not only studies, but practical realities. When we have a mass evacuation out of any area, you know, traffic just comes to a standstill anyway. So I stand by my assertion that anything that we need to mass evacuate for, be it a flood, be it a fire, be it, you know, be it an earthquake or, you know, goodness forbid, the nuclear option, that the shared vehicles or not shared vehicles is just not going to matter.
Yeah, and I get why for a lot of people shared vehicles are not an option today at all. Like, let's use a scenario where you have a small business where you have to go on location to work with your clients. Well, trying to Uber or Lyft to all of those.
Yeah.
That's not practical. You need to have your own car.
Yeah. Yeah. Even when we get to fully autonomous vehicles, it's going to be a very, very long time. I believe that it would very absolutely depend on a centralized system. By the way, we had people, I guess this is turning into like autonomous cars redux, and that's not even in the title today.
Not yet.
Right. But we had several people mention that any kind of centralized system is just far beyond our capabilities, mm-hmm. including some computer scientists who actually work on things like centralized systems, and like some like big brainiacs commented on that sort of offhanded mention for me. And for me, that sort of thing is essentially magic, in that it's technology that's so advanced that it's indistinguishable from magic. I think of that far in the future, not like something even in the next 20 years.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely, in my head, when I was talking about having centrally controlled systems that are, you know, essentially predicting where traffic is going to be, and managing all those vehicles and having vehicles be absolutely optimized in terms of their usage, all that kind of stuff, that is definitely like a far future kind of thing. The last thing I'm going to do is argue with the experts who actually understand the science behind that today.
Yeah, and I see a point where even if we move to autonomous vehicles just across the board, mm-hmm. there will still be people that, for whatever reason, need to own their own vehicle.
Yeah, or want to own their own vehicle.
Sure. And, you know, let's use the small business owner that has to go on mm-hmm. site to work with clients. I could see where that would be someone that would own their autonomous vehicle, and because they need to have that level of control and that ability to just change where they're going just in a moment's notice to accommodate the clients.
Or parents who, you know, spend their lives around their you know, getting their kids to all their various practices,
mm-hmm.
and team sports and ballet and you know, clubs and debate club and French club and, you know, all the other things like that. I mean, like, there are definitely lots of people who would want to own their own cars. The nifty thing is that when they weren't using that car, it could be being used by other people when they're asleep.
Sure. And it could be an owner's choice, you know, like Airbnb. Yeah,
of course. Absolutely. It would be. I mean, there are two sides of the coin to shared rides. There's you using someone else's car, but then there's also other people being able to use your car and, you know, helping you pay for your car when you're not using it. I would think that would actually apply even the most to business people who need their car, because they probably need their car during business hours or something close to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the day, they don't. Two sides of that coin.
Yeah. So my big takeaway from this right now is that if there's a nuclear attack around where you live, you're just going to hang tight. So is that
for a while, at least
for a while?
I laugh because it hurts.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Craig did not suggest that. That was my hyperbolic situation, the scenario. And so apologies to him. He also, by the way, he said that you sandwiched my question between Facebook digging into our lives, 1984, then closing with AI, 1984. The future of for transportation will be controlled by whom? 1984. I am scared. Fair point, sir.
No, or possibly very prescient.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, that's topic 0.1.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're still telling people what we're going to talk about.
Oh, okay.
So, topic one is, what do we have? We have Tim Cook, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, Apple, and privacy. That's all one thing.
That should be fast.
We've got Apple AI in the form of Apple hiring, and I can't remember the guy's name. Can't pronounce it. Even if I was looking at it right now, I would.
Former Google guy.
The formal Google guy, right? For it to be head of AI. We're going to talk about some of the implications of that. And then we're going to talk about what it's going to take to make HomeKit great again. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think you've got that just right.
Yeah, right. Right. So, Facebook, shall we?
All right, let's do it.
So what do we have here? We had, was it last week, Tim Cook gave an interview?
Yes.
And he was asked, well, I think something along the lines of what he would do if he was in Mark Zuckerberg's shoes.
And I loved his answer. I wouldn't be in that position.
I wouldn't be in that position. A very strong statement, at least coming from Tim Cook, who is often oblique about things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was nothing oblique about that.
It was kind of oblique. He could say that he could have been more direct. He could have said, "I would," you know. He could have been more direct about it from the standpoint of no company that I ran would ever make the kinds of mistakes that Facebook has made.
Okay, I sit corrected.
He could have said something along the lines of he could have actually just answered the question too. He could have said, well, you know, I think that what Facebook has to do is this and this and this and this. But instead, he chose the opportunity. And remember, every single word that comes out of Tim Cook's mouth, even when he's angry, is thought out.
Mm-hmm.
That man is the most careful speaker. He's the most controlled and strategic speaker, I think, in the ranks of technology execs.
Yeah, I will go with that. Yep. So he made a very big statement. He made a lot of statements, I think, with that one comment.
Yeah, he did. And he... What happened since then is that Mark Zuckerberg gave an interview. I'm going to find that. Being a top man, I didn't actually have it ready.
Sweet. So, yeah. So in that interview, the Zuckmeister offered up his rebuttal to Tim Cook, which, if I'm paraphrasing accurately, it was like, nuh-uh, you don't know.
You know, did you read my piece on this?
Mm-hmm.
So my title was Mark Zuckerberg says privacy is for the rich.
Yep. And
do you agree with that assessment?
Yes. And that's not the words he used, but the way he presented his argument, that's what he was saying.
I think it's the inescapable conclusion. Based on his reasoning, I don't think you can come to any other conclusion. I mean, so he said he was specifically asked about Tim Cook saying to him, you know, I wouldn't be in, or saying about him, I wouldn't be in that situation. And what Mr. Zuckerberg said was, you know, I find that argument that if you're not paying, that somehow we can't care about you, to be extremely glib and not at all aligned with the truth. Then he said, the reality here is that if you want to build a service that helps connect everyone in the world, then there are a lot of people who can't afford to pay.
Mm-hmm.
He also said, but if you want to build a service, which is not just serving rich people, actually, he made a dig at Apple. He said that, that doesn't mean we're not primarily focused on serving people. I think probably to the dissatisfaction of our sales team, I make all of our decisions, blah, blah, blah. And he said, I thought Jeff Bezos had an excellent saying on this in one of his Kindle launches. There are companies that work hard to charge you more, and there are companies that work hard to charge you less. And at Facebook, we are squarely in that camp. And then he said, but if you want to build a service which is not just serving rich people, then you need to have something that people can afford. And he said, to the contrary, I think it's important that we don't all get Stockholm syndrome, one of John Keats' phrases, and let the companies that work hard to charge you more convince you that they actually care about you more.
So on the surface, it seems like what he wants people to hear is, look, we're not charging you money, but that's because we love you.
The only way we can do Facebook is by harvesting you. Like, you know, if you want his whole thing, and like I read some other comments from him about connecting people and how, you know, like that's Facebook's mission. And he thinks it's super important for people to be connected, to get connected and to reconnect and to stay connected, which, you know, fine, I suppose. I don't necessarily accept his version of Facebook's raison d'etre as some sort of inescapable piece of obviousness.
Yeah, and if so, do you think Zuckerberg is feeling like if they don't exploit us as the product for advertisers, that Facebook can't function? Like if we all had to pay a fee to use the service, Facebook wouldn't be able to work.
He's right about a couple of things. It's where he takes that rightness that I personally take exception to. He's right that Apple products, and he didn't specifically name Apple, but he didn't have to. Apple products are affordable by the affluent. I had someone in my article, by the way, commented like, you know, look, I don't have a lot of money, but I scrimp and save and buy Apple products. Mm-hmm. Anyone here in the States, anyone in the Western world, which includes the vast majority of our readers, are far more affluent than most of the world. Even those of us who don't have a lot of money, and I count myself in that camp a lot.
Yeah, well, look at the industry we're in, of course.
Right. So, I mean, that's not a dig at anyone. That's not a dig at anyone. I mean, like, you know, affluence is certainly, you know, relevant. And certainly we, you know, there are a lot of people who use Apple products who are using hand-me-downs or devices they bought on the second market. What do you call that? Secondary market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people buy stuff off Craigslist and eBay and third-party resellers. And yeah,
just had a Washington Post headline.
Mm-hmm.
Buzz me this very second. Says Facebook says most people on its vast social network may have had their public profile scraped by third parties.
Sweet. Great.
Perfect timing. Perfect. I mean, that not making that up, that just came across my Apple Watch just now.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's just fantastic. So he's right that Apple products are relatively expensive. I mean, you know, look at what, you know, Apple occupies, like a laptop, Apple owns like, you know, 80% of the over $1,000 market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with phones, Apple makes all the profit because they're, you know, they're the company that's charging actual monies for their devices. Macs are expensive. iPhones are expensive relative to the vast majority of what's sold out there. Macs are expensive relative to what the majority of what's sold. Apple Watch isn't really all that expensive compared to other smartwatches. I guess it is more expensive, isn't it?
No, not really. It's if you want to compare it to very feature limited watches, you know, like fitness bands and stuff, yeah, it would be more expensive. But when you compare it to other full featured smartwatches, they're all in that same general price range.
Yeah, I think you can get Android Wear devices for, you know, $100 to $200. Under $100 even. I'm seeing some here. I'd say.
Ah. Well,
yeah, I mean, but one way or another, most of Apple stuff is more expensive. You're paying for quality. It's why we use it. That's fine. There are huge portions of the world that can never afford one. You know, I mean, you know, there are billions of people who, you know, make less than $2,000 or $3,000 a year.
Yes. And my guess is that for a lot of those people, their priorities, as far as technology goes, probably aren't in line with yours and mine. And that's not a negative thing. It's just they have different priorities.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, kind of, I would also add to Mr. Zuckerberg, that Facebook isn't serving them either. The economic demographic that is that low.
Mm-hmm.
So he's right about that. Where I think he goes wrong, and he's also right that one way to build a big platform is to make your customers your product. But he is saying that the only way to build a big platform is to make people the product. And I say that no, the only way to build, I'd correct that by saying that the only way to build a huge platform for free and make yourself a billionaire fast is to make people the product.
Well, and he has done that very well.
And he has done that well. There are certainly advertising supported models that don't require being as invasive into our lives as Facebook and Google are. But they're not going to become these multi-billion-dollar platforms overnight.
You know, with this,
and they may never become a multi-billion-dollar platform.
No, they may. We don't know. But with as invasive as Facebook is, I have to wonder, why do they feel like they need to build the incredibly detailed profiles or dossiers on us as users? I mean, but for example, do they really need to mine what we're doing on the Facebook platform and then build a political profile of who we are?
Well, those people, the third parties like Cambridge Analytica, they're doing that because they can.
So is Facebook. Like, you can see what Facebook thinks your political leaning is right now if you want.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Yeah. Have you ever done that?
No, I have not gone to go look and see what they're getting from me yet.
Oh my God. Okay. So for those of you playing along at home, go to your Facebook account settings and then go to ads and then go to your information. And, then I'm doing it right now. So I got all the steps right. Okay. And then choose your categories. And it includes all kinds of interesting things about yourself. Like, and one of the things that's there is your politics, how they rate you politically.
And to answer your question, according to the model established by Facebook, yes, they do that because they do need that. Because from Facebook's standpoint, they're going to use that information to connect you, and they're going to pay for that by then also taking the same information and providing access to you to advertisers. and sometimes just providing that information straight out, although they seem to be on track to limit that, which would be good.
Yeah, I agree. That would be good.
I mean, but if you look at how all of this started, Google made the decision that, you know what, we're going to build Google and we're going to worry about monetizing later. Advertising was not the advertising profiles, the targeted advertising, all that stuff. That was not the original purpose. That wasn't the original, like the Google wasn't built to be an engine for that. Google was built to be a search engine, and they were looking for a way to monetize that. And they stumbled across the idea, or, you know, deeply thought out, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, targeted advertising model, and then everything snowballed from there. But the object was to get the users first, monetize later. Now, and then everybody else has done the same thing. That's what Facebook did. Get the users first, we'll monetize later. It's what Twitter did. It's what Instagram did.
Mm-hmm.
It's what WhatsApp did. It's what all these various social platforms in particular have done. And it's, you know, that has become the mantra. You get the users. I mean, and really, of course, you have all these VCs and young tech entrepreneurs both who want you to get the users and then just sell the company.
Yeah. Which is, there was a time when that wasn't a good business model, but it seems pretty popular now.
It does. And that's one thing I'll give Zuckerberg credit for. You know, Steve Jobs complained about that. He complained about young tech people not being willing to put in the hard work, that they just wanted to build the company and sell it and get out. Mm-hmm. And we certainly have seen a lot of that. And that's one area that I'll give Mark Zuckerberg credit, is he stayed with Facebook and turned it into the platform that buys other companies.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
try singing it. You just seemed like the words were stuck.
Yeah, well, I've got so much that I disagree with. The thing that I was sort of like staring at just then was Jeff Bezos's comment about there are companies that work hard to charge you more and there are companies that work hard to charge you less. Well, charging less for something is not always good. As a matter of fact, it's often bad. You know, my big complaint with Facebook is that they're sucking the quality out of everything they touch.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that. I don't like that with my books. I don't like that with anything. I don't like crap. I got this wooden art box to keep all my wax stamp
mm-hmm.
seals and my wax and, you know, my fountain pens and things like that. I couldn't really find anything anywhere that I wanted to get. You know, what I really want to do is get a campaign desk from, you know, like, you know, the 19th century.
That would be really cool.
Yeah. And the good ones are expensive and the cheap ones are, you know, are antiques that are not going to stand up to any kind of ongoing use. And I was looking for anything that was modern. You know, I wasn't looking for cheap. I'm looking for something that is that I can afford to get that's going to be a higher quality. I could never find anything. All the art boxes I was looking at didn't quite work. But then I did find one on Amazon. It was $40, and I was actually alarmed at the low price because it's made out of wood. How good quality is it going to be? It was $40. Bought it anyway. I got it. The design is great, and, you know, surprise, the materials are cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a local art store too. We have a great, there's like, I don't know, 3/4 of a mile from me. There's a fantastic art supply store, and they didn't have anything, unfortunately, that would do for me. My point is that the race to the bottom is not necessarily, and in all cases, a great thing. Certainly, I don't want everything to be as expensive as it could possibly be. I'm not made out of money, but I do like buying quality things. And the race to the bottom is a threat to quality things. That, I guess, that's my point.
Yeah, so I'll agree with you on that. Yep.
Holding up Jeff Bezos' statement here as some sort of justification for making me the product carries no water with me whatsoever.
Yeah. It feels like with that statement, what he's trying to do is characterize Facebook as the good guy and Apple as the bad guy.
Right. And I can understand why he's feeling defensive. I mean, Tim Cook did slam him. I wouldn't be in that position.
And considering the position Facebook is in right now, I imagine that Mark Zuckerberg is feeling just pretty defensive all the way around right now.
Yeah, I agree with that. There was that. Did you see that letter, that email that one of his top lieutenant, I think his name is Bosworth, called Boz, this is a nickname. And he said that basically sometimes connecting people isn't good, like, you know, connecting people with bullies.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, he had a couple of examples, and Tim Cook, Mark Zuckerberg was asked about that. And he's like, you know, Boz's whole, you know, thing is to push our boundaries and make us, you know, push our thinking on things. I just happen to disagree with this particular sentiment in the strongest terms. I think that's more or less what he said. I would imagine that he is feeling quite defensive, and this kind of comes back to this point for me that the difference between Mark Zuckerberg and tech icons from the hardware days is that when young people like, you know, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak were the young tech gurus who were, you know, who were doing all these crazy things and earning enormous amounts of money, they weren't doing so based on using us as the product. And Mark Zuckerberg, when he was making Facebook into the big thing, he didn't have the life experience to understand that difference between what he can do, what he could do, and what he should do.
Mm-hmm.
It's what all this always comes back down to me.
And so now here we are with people listening to the show that just went and looked at their Facebook profile. They're like, holy crap, Facebook has assigned a political classification to me. And then the other side of that is, and they got it right.
Yes. I think there's a lot that Facebook knows about us. I mean, you know, I think as a far more egregious example, it would be, can we experiment on the minds of our users by controlling the kinds of content that the kinds of things in their newsfeed from their friends? And the answer to that is yes, we can. But the other question that they should have then asked is, should we do so? And the answer there was clearly no, we should not. That's the thing I'm talking about. It's that difference, what we could do and what we should do.
So they clearly didn't pay close attention to Jurassic Park. That's the big line from Malcolm. They were so busy. Yeah,
fair point.
Figuring out what they could do that they didn't stop to think if they should.
Right. And the implication is a little bit different there, but
because we're not going to get eaten by dinosaurs from Facebook.
Yeah. Right. John Welch had a comment to me. Let me find it. He said, Brian, I think this is on Twitter. It was his account's private, so you wouldn't be able to see this. Oh, you might. Are you friends with John?
Yes, I am.
So he said to me on Twitter, he said, I think most people would be appalled at how little, if any, time is given to ethics in computer science programs. Maybe not surprised, but appalled. Doesn't exist. There's maybe one class that's required, and it's viewed as a total waste of time. And so we have Zuckerberg. Fair point, sir.
Wow. Like, it didn't even occur to me that there wouldn't be ethics as a core part of a program like that. But hearing John's statement, of course, it's not an important thing. And and so here we have Zuckerberg.
And here we have Zuckerberg. All right. So now on a much more positive and happy note, Apple has hired, what's that guy's name? Let's find that name. Top man. Top men. Google, there we go. Hired Google's former chief of search and artificial intelligence, and his name is John Giandrea. What do you think about that? Giandrea?
Let's go with that.
I think everyone calls him JG.
I say we can go with that too.
I would probably call him Mr. G.
I like that. Let's call him Mr. G.
Yeah, but I think in reality people call him JG.
This isn't reality, it's a podcast.
Fair enough. So Mr. G, for the purposes of the rest of the conversation, we will refer to John Giandrea, Mr. G. We're going to call him Mr. G. And he was Google's chief of search and artificial intelligence, and Apple has hired him to head Apple's artificial intelligence efforts.
That's actually really interesting. So I have a question.
Yeah.
Does this mean that Apple is about to just like overtake the whole artificial intelligence thing? Or does this mean that they're desperately trying to catch up?
Well, I still think that Apple has laid the right foundations for AI, but they're being built in terms of practical effects, certainly by Google and by Amazon too, which is just still really weird. So I don't know if it's so much that Apple is desperately trying to catch up as that Tim Cook is focused on accelerating their efforts. And okay. I think there's a difference, and I don't think that I'm being, you know, I don't think I'm being Mr. like fanboy or rose colored glasses there, because I do think that Apple has laid the right foundations. They are teaching Siri how to properly understand us and not teaching her to be a really clever parrot. With apologies to parrots who are kind of awesome.
So, all right, so I'm thinking about this. I like the idea of Apple having the right people on board with the AI skills to really advance what they're doing and finding a way to leapfrog what Google and Amazon to a degree are doing without really sacrificing our privacy. Do you think that's something he can do?
Yeah, I do. You're talking about Apple's, you're talking in part about the way Apple's commitment to our privacy serves as a roadblock or a speed bump to Apple developing AI. Is this correct?
Yeah, I feel like Apple, compared to what Google is doing, is operating in a hobbled fashion because they are choosing to not mine our personal information in the way Google is. Okay, but you know, actually, now that I say that, am I talking about AI here, or am I talking about having a system that can just parse through so much data about us that it feels like AI?
Well, there's machine learning and there's AI, right? And there's neural nets, and neural nets to facilitate both. There's deep neural nets, and Apple has, you know, been working deep neural nets and whatnot. But you know what Apple hasn't had is someone like Mr. G in charge of this, and he's going to be answering directly to Tim Cook. He's one of 16 executives that answer directly to Tim Cook.
Okay, that's really telling right there. I mean, if they have someone that's part of their AI team now, and they're answering directly to Tim, that says that Apple is now really serious about being a big player in this space.
You know, I'm going to tweak that a little bit, Jeff.
Okay.
I think Apple has always been serious about this. I think Apple may be more committed to doing what it takes to be serious. And there's,
I like that.
I don't think that's just a semantic and pedantic wordplay there.
You know, I'm going to let you slide on pedantry on this one instead of giving you a hard time, because I think your angle on this is actually probably spot on.
Well, first of all, you're slipping.
Some days I'm just nice
passed
to you.
Off. Passed up an opportunity to harsh on me for something.
But some days I'm just nice to you. Brian, this is how I keep you on your toes, because you don't know when it's coming.
That's true. I don't. This is an excellent point. I think it's going to be interesting, because Rick Allen had suggested to me privately that he asked if this meant that Apple was turning AI into more of its own platform by making this guy a direct report to Tim Cook.
That's a good question. I'm going to take a crack at this. I think that Siri as its own platform is not a completely accurate way to describe this, because Siri is a voice interface to what Apple hopes will be a powerful artificial intelligence. And then Apple will be able to use that as a cohesive element in their overall larger platform.
Okay. Well, how is this going to end up playing with, we've talked about, you and I, Jeff, have talked about the idea that Apple seemed to cling to this, operate like a startup to its detriment.
Mm-hmm.
That as the company grew, that the leadership circle wasn't growing to keep pace with everything that Apple was doing.
Maybe Apple is addressing that now.
Maybe Apple is addressing that now. And I think that actually may be the case. I was actually surprised that there are 16 direct reports. That actually seems like a lot of direct reports.
Actually, 16, yeah, it does.
I mean, especially for a company that is as relatively light on its executive ranks to begin with. 16 direct reports. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I haven't studied the exact hierarchical structures of enough of the companies to really have an opinion on that. So, it did surprise me, but it one way or another, it is certainly an expansion of that circle of lieutenants. And that's one of the things that we've been wanting to see at Apple, is more lieutenants, more people who are making all these decisions, as opposed to, you know, the top lieutenants being spread too thin.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now here's my next question. With 16 lieutenants reporting directly to Tim Cook, is that spreading it too thin again?
Well, yeah. Should there maybe be four people to whom the other 12 are reporting, and then the four people report to Tim. I don't know. Sure. Like I said, I haven't studied the hierarchical structure of enough of other companies to really have an opinion there.
Yeah.
One way or another, though, this is another person making more decisions, and that's good. The question is, how is it going to play with iOS and macOS? With Siri being a direct report, with artificial intelligence being a direct report to Tim, how is that going to work with the integration with iOS and macOS and HomePod OS and tvOS and watchOS?
Well, what I'm hoping is that the way all this comes together is that we get this system where we can talk far more naturally to our devices, and they'll be able to understand what we're saying, but also
regardless of how we say it,
but also they can parse context.
Right. Yeah. Right. Regardless of how we say it. And that's where I think that Apple's foundation is strong. And that what Apple needs to do is accelerate what it's doing as opposed to changing what it's doing. Mm-hmm. And that's where Mr. G may well come in handy. Now, it's interesting that that Tim Cook wrote a letter to employees, which is how the New York Times found out about this, by the way. They were the ones who broke the story. And in that letter to employees, Mr. Cook said, quote, "Our technology must be infused with the values we all hold dear. Mr. G shares our commitment to privacy and our thoughtful approach as we make computers even smarter and more personal," which is in part a, you know, quintupling or, you know, octupling down on Apple's commitment to privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it could actually have been a reassurance to employees that, yeah, we're hiring this guy from Google, but that doesn't mean that we're going to start, you know, doing Google's thing of invading our customers' privacy.
Apple's in a very interesting place with all of this because they're choosing to not take the easy path.
Yes.
If they get this right, it's going to pay off so well. And
if they get it right,
yep, if they get it right. Yeah.
That moment in time when Siri actually becomes better again than everything else will be a sweet, delicious moment.
Yeah. And well, you know, honestly, I don't think Siri is worse than the other voice platforms. And I say this as the guy that has a smart speaker for all three of the big platforms and use all of them regularly. And have at times been very critical, but also I'm more than happy to praise him. And generally speaking, that's kind of funny. I'm talking about speaking to the speakers. Anyhow, generally speaking, if I had to pick a single voice control platform to use, I would want it to be Siri. It just feels so much better overall. I feel like it's just more reliable in general. And I'm saying that even though right now I'm leaning more towards the A-Lady platform.
Right.
But I'd prefer it to be the S-Lady.
Understood on all fronts. And I suspect that at some point you will come back to...
Abandoned S-Lady completely. I have just very narrowly defined where right now it's appropriate for me to use that. So, but I haven't turned my back on the S-Lady.
Right. Right. So one other thing, Tim Cook knows that any letter he writes to employees is going to be leaked to the press.
Yeah, I assumed that he wrote the letter for employees, but also for the public.
Yeah, but just didn't want to put it in a press release.
Sure. And what a great way to do it.
yes, Apple is in that unique position to do things like this. So I'm stoked about what this might mean. And I hope that, you know, it would be terrific as far as I'm concerned, is if one reason why Mr. G took this job is because he does have this commitment to privacy, and that wasn't just Tim Cook asserting that he has that commitment to privacy.
Yeah.
That would be terrific. We don't know. I don't know enough about him. I don't know anything about him except for what I've learned from the course of covering this development. But that would be terrific. I'd be excited. I guess only time will tell.
Yeah. And my guess is that we'll have to be patient, as hard as that is, because these are the sorts of technologies that don't happen quickly. At least I don't think they do.
Right. Agreed. So, speaking of HomeKit and Siri,
yes.
What is it going to take? You know, we've both been critical, and I don't want to be critical about Apple on this, in that we have both been critical a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we could actually sort of approach the issue of HomeKit from the other direction. And like, what would it take for Apple to make HomeKit all that we want it to be?
Oh, I've got a list of things.
Okay.
So the first thing, and this will come as no surprise, based on the Rantapalooza editorial that I wrote the other day, it needs to be less fragile. And by that I mean, if something goes wrong, there needs to be a graceful way to recover instead of having to wipe everything and start from scratch. So maybe in my case, where it got stuck in this sinking loop and there was no way to get out, at some point, give me an alert saying, hey, it looks like that there's some problem, and would you like us to roll back to the last HomeKit settings update? You may lose some of your settings. It's like, yes. If I lose a light bulb or a scene, that's a lot better than losing everything. So that's the first thing Apple could do to make this a lot better.
Okay. All right. But that's addressing a symptom. Like, I mean, that's Apple has a, you know, Apple has the situation that you described with your travails is pretty shocking. But even fixing that is merely addressing one particular issue.
All right. So
for having HomeKit be everything that we want and need it to be.
Okay. Here's something else. The ability to present the commands to my smart home through voice in a way that's more natural. And specifically what I mean is being able to say something like, "Yo Siri, I'm home." And then that triggers whatever my I'm home event is with all the lights and things that happen. But it's part of the same sentence. I can continue on and say, turn off the outdoor lights, lock the front door, and set the living room lights to 50%. And so now I've given this whole string of commands and created actually a very complex interaction with HomeKit, and all of the stuff can simply happen. So I guess what I'm saying is create a much more robust link between Siri and HomeKit, which maybe that'll come out of Mr. G's job at Apple.
Yeah, we can hope so. Yep.
Yep. Another thing that I think would make this far more useful, not just for me, but for other people, is if HomeKit expanded to support additional platforms. So start by giving me HomeKit control from my Mac. And then
it's so ridiculous that we can't do HomeKit from our Mac.
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous that the more powerful device with the more flexible interface can't do HomeKit stuff.
Sure. Can you imagine being able to make a HomeKit scene on your Mac where you can just drag and drop elements and it's just this graphic thing where you're clicking everything together?
I would love that.
What we have right now on iOS, it's functional, but I don't think it's as approachable to the average user as it could be.
Well, in some ways, it's pretty easy to use on iOS, but it's limited.
Yeah. Now using it on iOS, I think is pretty easy overall. It's when you go to set scenes up, create special trigger actions, those sorts of things. I think that there's room for improvement there, and being able to create those same things on a Mac with the type of interface you can create in macOS, I think that would make this much more approachable to a wider range of people.
Okay, fair enough. I've got something at a much more holistic level, though.
Okay.
Apple could become much more invested with helping third-party companies implement HomeKit in their products and deploy HomeKit within their products.
I wonder if that's going to be happening. Maybe already is happening behind the scenes. And the reason I say this, Brian, is because with iOS 11.3, HomeKit support for devices expands out to include devices that are already on the market that don't have the HomeKit specific chips in them. So now a device maker that already has, say, some sort of smart switch on the market, a smart light bulb that hasn't supported HomeKit before, they can do software updates or firmware updates for their devices that add that in at a software level.
That's good, and that's actually I think that is one of that is a good thing. That's maybe even a great thing. But
yeah, I think that's a very exciting thing for Apple.
I feel like, though, and this is supported by anecdotal evidence, that Apple has made HomeKit and is leaving it up to developers to come to it. And what I would like to see is, I would like to see Apple have the kind of team that you would probably expect from Microsoft, whose job is to bend over backwards to answer any questions, to help with development, to reach out and push HomeKit to help people implement it, test it, develop their you know, promotional strategies, maybe certainly work with them on software. Right, the kind of outreach team that Apple traditionally doesn't do. Apple usually builds stuff, and you know, if you're a developer who's interested in it, maybe Apple will let you come and play with their toys. Maybe.
You know, that's a really good point. Apple needs an outreach program for HomeKit developers.
Yeah, a significant one.
Yeah,
now, Apple has the money to make this a thing. I think this is something that would benefit the Apple ecosystem greatly. You know, and maybe they're doing some of that and we just don't see it. But I know that when I've talked to the smart home vendors at places like CES and you know, Pepcom and the like, that I'm not getting any information about Apple's direct help.
I haven't heard anything either. And what I remember hearing a lot at CES this year, so that would have been January, the smart home device makers talked about the Amazon platform, the A-Lady first. And then they would say, oh, yes, and we have HomeKit support. And then they would more often than not say, oh, we're thinking about Google, which I found to be just fascinating. So
this is fascinating.
Yeah. So, hey, they like HomeKit better than Google. At least there's that.
Yeah.
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 Well, I think that HomeKit has so much potential. And I mean, we're 4 years into HomeKit being a thing. And the first wave of HomeKit, I feel, was very, very limited because Apple had this thing locked down so much and so restrictive for developers that it was really difficult for them to create HomeKit products. It seems to me that it's getting much easier to make HomeKit compatible devices. And now with iOS 11.3 happening, it becomes easier yet again. So couple that with the outreach program that hopefully they have going right now. And if not, okay, get that started right away, please. This has a lot of potential for what HomeKit can be.
Yeah. I agree with that. One way or another, I think that Apple is going to get there. Yes. I think that Apple sees, I don't think HomeKit's going to become abandonware like we've seen so many things with Apple. I don't think that's going to be the case here.
Yeah. Apple has the resources and the persistence to stick this out and make HomeKit a flagship platform.
Yeah.
And I'd really like to see that happen.
Indeed. And with that, though, I think we're out of time.
Yeah, we're actually a little bit over out of time, but not by much. So I know exactly how we can take care of that problem. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for us. And that's all for this week.
And hey, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.
Hey, I hit the wrong button. That was pretty awesome. Let's try this one.